Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Right, welcome to another episode of the Science of Sport podcast. And as you saw by the title, it's not a subject that we would normally cover in terms of sport, but it is all about fitness, whether it's physical fitness, emotional fitness, mental fitness, all the elements of fitness. And we're going to be talking to a gentleman who has used fitness in pretty much a life or death situation. His name is Richie Poynter, who was a former Green Beret as part of the Royal Marines, and he has amazing stories to tell around not only the training that the Royal Marines do and what the sort of physical aspect of what they do as Royal Marines, but also the physical and emotional and mental, and particularly the mental side. And you'll hear him talking a lot about something called dislocation of expectation, which I absolutely love. And when you understand what that means, there's lots of ways you can actually apply it to sport. But Ross, he really is the real McCoy, isn't he? He's not G.I. Jane here. This guy is, you can hear in the way that he talks. He's been there, done that.
Yeah, I met him in London in May, I think it was. I was there for a little while on a work trip, and I always travel these days with my bicycle. And he saw me doing some rides, and he dropped me a message on Strava. He said, "Hey, I'm a patron, so thanks for that, Richie." Mm-hmm. And that's how he got hold of me. He said, "Listen, I'm going to be in the area on Friday. Let's go for a ride." So I said, "No worries, let's do this." And I showed up that Friday morning, and I met him, and I took one look at him. I thought, "Oh boy, I'm in trouble here," because he looked the part. And then we start cycling. "So what do you do? He says, "I used to be a Royal Marine." I thought maybe I should fake a puncture, because I knew I was in for a tough couple hours. And it was. We did an amazing ride, and then we ended up having first a cup of coffee and then a couple beers. And it was there that he actually said to me he thinks it would make for an interesting topic to explore how his training and what he knows about what they do in the Royal Marines taught him about performance in sport. And so I said, "No, tell me more." And we chatted for a couple of hours, and it's too good not to do.
Yeah, I mean, he is absolutely, and as I said right at the start here, there are so many lessons from what he talks about, and none of us will probably ever go through marine training, but there are principles there that I actually took a lot out of. So we'll get onto that in just a few moments. So before we get into the interview with Richie, and I hope you stay with us for that, because it really is brilliant, let's have our usual look back. And we always have a segment in our podcast every week talking about things that caught our eye. And don't forget, you can be part of that discussion on our group on Patreon. So if you are a Patreon member, you can send us a question. We've got a couple of questions to deal with this week. But Ross, what caught our eye this week?
Well, we're still using what caught my eye as opposed to patrons. It would help both of us if the patrons came to this and said, "Listen, here's some ideas," because it'll save me having to pay attention and it'll give you a chance to have a voice also. So a couple of things this week. The first was, I got a message from Torbjorn Jonsson from...
Must be Norwegian.
Correct. Very good. Norway. And It's actually a correction, because two podcasts back, we spoke a little bit about women's sport, and we were discussing tennis, you may recall, and I got some stats wrong, and Torbjorn very politely corrected me. He said, "I keep enjoying your podcast, but in your tennis stats about former Grand Slam champs, you said Murray won one, he's actually got three, and you forgot Wawrinka, who also has three. Besides that, all press from Norway." So thanks, Torbjorn. Consider me dunked on.
Take it on the chin.
But he's right. You know, have you ever begun to tell a joke and then you realize halfway through that you don't know the punchline? That's what happened when I was telling you those tennis stats. I remember distinctly going into that discussion and saying, "Yeah, Federer, Nadal and Djokovic have obviously won loads, but there's a couple," and then I didn't know who they were. And I remember trying to be vague, but I wasn't vague enough for our listeners. But what I then did was, just inspired by Torbjorn's correction, is I went actually and had a look at this. So Roger Federer's first Grand Slam title was in 2003 at Wimbledon.
Wow.
Since then, there have been 75 Grand Slam tournaments, men and women each. And on the men's side, there have been 12 unique champions.
Wow.
On the women's side, there have been 29 unique champions. On the men's side, obviously, you've got the big three. You've won, two of them have won 20, and then Nadal now on 22. So that alone accounts for 62 out of the 75 Grand Slams have gone to those three players. Then, obviously, you get Murray and Wawrinka with three each.
Yep.
On the women's side, Serena Williams has 18. The next best is six, Justine Henin.
Wow.
Then five. Then we have a couple with two, a handful with three, and so on. And 13 different women have won one Grand Slam. So more women have won only one title than men in total have won Grand Slams since Roger Federer won his first one.
Yeah, it's definitely, we can look at getting a tennis specialist in here because that's a fascinating discussion.
So the thing that's missing, obviously, is to go back pre-Roger Federer and ask whether men's tennis looked like women's does now, with like just major chaos. That's how I'd describe this. It's high flux. And I mean, high honestly, churn. I could give you the names of some of these one-time women champions. And I reckon if you weren't quite a close follower of tennis, you wouldn't recognize half of them.
Yep.
And that's how much flux and unpredictability there is in women's tennis. And I suppose the debate is that healthy or no? Because in one respect, it's good. Unpredictability is valuable. But in other respects, it means you don't get the entrenchment of personalities and brands and so on to write stories off of. So it's an interesting difference between the men's and the women's game. And anyway, that was inspired by Torbjorn's correction.
Yeah, and I absolutely think that's a very critical point you made there, because I think in sport, and I'm on the side of the discussion around publicity around sport, that if you have a few players that dominate, it actually is better for the sport because people have heroes to identify with, and people, the media, you look at a guy like Nadal, there's been thousands of stories written by him. People get to know him, his training regimes, he becomes a hero within the sport. Whereas if you have this churn and flux, you don't necessarily have any point of looking at somebody and saying, well, you know, Serena Williams is an example, but the other 16 players you're talking about, as you say, are probably only know a handful of them.
And it hasn't always been that way. You go back to the 80s, you had Everett and Navratilova.
Yep.
Then you had a period with Graf and Sabatini and Monica Seles.
Yep.
Capriati, Hingis were personalities. Then the Belgians, Clijsters and Henin. And then obviously the Williams sisters. So it does happen. It's just unusual at the moment that it hasn't happened for so long. And that's why the media overreacts to the emergence of a Naomi Osaka, who's got four, by the way, quite high on that list, relatively.
Relatively young, too.
And then you get Emma Raducanu, who wins the US Open last year, is the next big thing, hasn't made a major final since, in dark for Wimbledon. So, it's an interesting space. And I suppose the challenge is, how do you make the name without giving them a platform? But no one's giving them a platform because they aren't names.
Yeah.
I think the current number one, this Iga Swiatek, is a potential to become a multiple. She's already got a couple, but she may well go into double figures unless someone figures out how to play against her. Anyway, so that, I thought that was interesting.
I find it similar to golf in some respects. When Tiger Woods was dominating, you kind of knew the top five, and they were always the pretenders to Tiger Woods. And since his decline, there's been a lot of golf players at the top, but nobody that really stands out.
I dare say marathon running, it's one of the big challenges about, Gebre Selassie maybe was different. Kipchoge certainly is.
Yeah.
You know, there have been stories about him and how he lives and so on. Mm. But for the most part, their careers are so short. They're very difficult to build story arcs around.
And you think how great Kipchoge has been over the last 10 years. And yes, he is a big personality, but it's taken him almost those 10 years of absolutely outstanding performances to get that notoriety.
Exactly. Yeah. Then second one, Trip Hawthorne, patron member. Thanks, Trip, for that. Sent a message saying, good morning. I'm an age group triathlete here in Louisiana on the U.S. Gulf Coast. Our challenge here is not so much heat as it is humidity. My impression is that one can train to adapt to heat, and that mechanism of that adaptation is to sweat more, but there doesn't seem to be any way to adapt to high humidity. Is that correct? Am I better off training indoors and saving myself for the suffering that comes with running outside in 85 degrees and 90% humidity, or is there some value in that? So it's a good question. Thanks for that. So a couple of things Tripp has asked and said. First one is, the mechanism of adaptation is to sweat more. That's absolutely the case. Studies that have been done on heat acclimation show that the first thing that changes is we sweat more and our plasma volume goes up in order to allow that. So we literally produce more plasma and our ability to recruit sweat glands improves. So that helps keep us cool. It's probably the main thing driving heat adaptation. Where it gets interesting, and this is also true, is that humidity is a major factor. We discussed in our most recent pod that some data shows that temperature is maybe the main contributor to optimal weather or suboptimal, followed by humidity. Mm-hmm. And the combination of those two ultimately determines your capacity for exercise. Recall that heat storage, which can be either positive, i.e. I'm getting hotter, or heat loss, which can be negative, then I'm getting colder, is a function of the difference between what heat I produce and what I lose. Make sense?
Yeah.
Heat production is exercise, heat loss is environment.
Yeah.
Heat loss comes from convection, which is wind or water, and heat, and it comes from evaporation of sweat. Sweat that drips off us does not remove heat, only when it evaporates.
Mm.
And the problem with high humidity is that it doesn't allow sweat to evaporate. And that's why when you get an optimal combination, well, it's not optimal, it's exactly the opposite, of high temperatures plus high humidity, we can no longer lose heat through air cooling because the air is warmer than our body. So in fact, we gain heat from the air and we can't evaporate the sweat. So therefore, we've got no heat loss avenues left. And that's the biggest problem. That's what's called an uncompensable environment, heat environment. And I remember when I started my studies, I read a paper that was written around the time of the Atlanta Olympics, and it was called A Fight Against Physics by a Danish researcher, Bodil Nielsen. And they were basically saying that given the averaged conditions in Atlanta, this marathon will be lethal because they knew that it would be 30 degrees and 80% humidity. In the end, it wasn't. In fact, our guy won it. You know, well, it wasn't fast, but it's relatively quick.
Just side to Guani, yeah.
Exactly. Mm. Now, the question that Tripp asks off the back of this is, should I train indoors and save myself, or is there any benefit?
In adaptation to heat.
Yeah. If you are going to race in the heat, you must adapt to it.
Mm.
You can't get in and out, like sneak in and out before the heat hits you in a race. Some people have thought that, you know, you can train in the cool, get myself ready, and then go 90 minutes in the heat and out again. No. Doesn't work. The heat will hurt.
Yep.
So you have to adapt to the heat. That's why even tennis players, you know, they're going to be playing in Australia. They go do hot training sessions. You must adapt to what you're going to prepare for. Where it gets really interesting is whether you can train in the heat in order to adapt for benefits in the cold. You know, like at altitude, you'll go up and you'll train at altitude to improve sea level performance.
Yes.
There is now a theory, and some studies are coming out to support it, that if you train in heat, you'll get benefits in cold weather. So you train at one extreme in order to see benefits at the baseline. Make sense?
Not really, to be honest with you, because should the adaptations for cold conditions are different?
Normal. So not cold as in like -5.
Yes.
15 degrees, perfect marathon running weather, right. 9-10 degrees. So the thing is...
So they're not extremes you're talking about.
Not extremes.
Right.
What we're saying is, can we train in hot, challenging environments in order to get better for the marathon in optimal environments?
I see what you mean, yes.
Makes sense now?
Right, got it.
And the answer is maybe. And so there's one study, and this is why this particular question of Tripp caught my eye, other than the fact that it was in my inbox. And this is a study published in 2021 by Ed Maunder out of New Zealand. And what they basically did was they took 17 endurance athletes and they gave them a three-week training block, either at 33 degrees, which is hot, or at 18 degrees, which is mild. And then they tested their performance either side of that training block. And sure enough, the group that trained in the heat got better at cool temperatures than the group that trained in the mild temperature.
So, maybe because they were effectively just training harder.
They controlled. So that's a very good observation. They control for that. So when you read the paper, training was matched for relative cardiovascular demand using heart rates measured during the test that they did before. So the cardiovascular stress was the same, yet they still got a better performance difference.
Okay.
So they said, well, why might that be? And they measured, for instance, enzyme activity that is a marker for how many mitochondria they have. Remember, the mitochondria are basically responsible for converting fuel into ATP. Yeah. And so they find that citrate synthase activity, which is directly proportional to mitochondria, goes up in the heat-trained group, but not in the cool-trained group.
Right.
So if you train in the heat, you might get metabolic adaptations that make you better at delivering fuel to your muscles, and you also start increasing your fat-burning capacity, and therefore you might get better in cool conditions.
That's brilliant.
It's really interesting.
That's very interesting.
So this is a newish field.
So hot, warm weather training is better for you. If everything is the same, warm weather training is better for you because
could,
of adaptation.
Could be. I'm always cautious to be.
Yes. There are studies to support that.
Correct. And so in answer to Tripp's question, that if you're training for something hot, then you have to do that. If you're training for something cool, you might want to do that training in the first place. But now you've got to be careful because there's trade-off here. Just like at altitude, if you go out and it's 85 degrees and 90% humidity, I guarantee you, you're not having a good training session.
Yeah.
You're getting a benefit of the cardiovascular and maybe the metabolic advantage, but you're not going to run fast and you're not going to run well or cycle, whatever it is, right?
Right.
So you have to pick very carefully when you load yourself that way compared to saying, today I want performance. Today I need optimal conditions for peak performance in training, whereas on this day I need heat for optimal adaptation. Mm. Same as at altitude. You can go to altitude and you'll get the benefit of thinner air, thinner less oxygen, but you won't be able to train as well. So what you gain in one area, you might lose in another. Correct. Same thing for the heat. So Trip, the answer is you have to be very cautious and judicious about how you load the heat into your training. Because if you do it too often, you'll finish yourself off. You'll be exhausted, overtrained, burned out, tired, and then nothing will help. So you got to be, if you choose right, you can actually get a benefit from those conditions that will help you in your performance.
So fascinating. That's interesting. So if you have a choice between going to the Ural Mountains in the middle of winter or training in the mild spring of England or something like that, then obviously the mild spring in England would be a lot better off than training in the cold. In other words, if you go and train and you want to train and benefit, you're not going to go to a cold environment because actually a warm environment but supposedly gives you better results.
Could do, yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing. So it's really very interesting.
It is, indeed.
It's because the general concept of stress on physiology applies.
Mm.
Heat just creates a different kind of stress on the physiology. Mm. And as a result, we get better. And the body doesn't care about when we get better. We just get better.
Well, you know, England's having their summer now, all the Northern Hemisphere people, so enjoy the warm weather because you are getting a lot of benefit. Anyway, so let's move on to our interview. It is Richie Poynter, our Marine, who's going to give us some insight into being a Marine and how it applies to sports. Well, Richard, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. We know that you and Ross had a bit of a ride around the London or the English countryside a month or so ago. And when Ross came back and said that I met this quite hardcore cyclist who made me bleed on the hills, I realized that we were speaking to must be somebody close to an elite type rider if you were putting Ross in the pain cave.
Yeah, that's pretty flattering to me, to be honest with you, to say I was elite level, but
very flattering. Yeah, me.
but yeah, that's correct. Yeah, myself and Ross went for a very it was a good ride in some nice weather around the Surrey Hills, and we had a good recuperation session afterwards. I think it's pretty fair to say we started off on a cup of tea and transferred to some lager shandies pretty soon after.
Just which is probably also
not elite athlete behavior either. Sorry.
Well, Richard, it really is fascinating to talk to you. And as we've said in the intro, this is not a traditional Science of Sport podcast, but there are so many things that we're looking forward to chatting to you about with your experience as a Royal Marine and the physical side of things, but also the mental and I guess the emotional side of the training that you went through and how that applies to not only your own cycling, but a lot of events and endurance events, particularly that we talk about on this podcast. So it's exciting. So just give us a bit of a brief idea about how long you were at the Royal Marines and what was the motivation for joining the Royal Marines? That's always an interesting question.
Yeah, okay. So I joined the Royal Marines, or I joined recruit training in the Royal Marines in 2010. And I was in the Royal Marines for 5 years. It was a reasonably busy and kinetic period of time for the UK and the Royal Marines, especially around then. And that included some tours of Afghanistan, some trips around the Middle East and Mediterranean, and then some sort of training exercises and stuff in the Mojave Desert, the US Marines as well. I guess motivation-wise, you know, what got me through the front door, which is the first barrier to entry, the front door of the Armed Forces Careers Office. I think I had a sort of a moment of clarity, I think, where I think I all along from being quite young, I knew I wanted to join the military. I didn't have any family background in the military, which a lot of people do, and they sort of follow in their father's footsteps, for instance. I didn't have that, but I think I've always been keen and interested in the military, and I just found that I woke up and I thought, I will regret not doing this if I don't give it a go. You know, I really wanted to test my mettle and see if I had what it took, and that really was the motivator to get me through that across the threshold and put my name on the dotted line.
I always find it interesting because here in South Africa, we, you know, 20 odd years ago, maybe even more closer to 30 years ago, we had conscription here where people were forced to go to the army and a lot of people didn't want to go, but a lot of people did go. Is there, at a very basic level, when you're going into the army at the level that you were in a time when there was a lot of conflict involving the armed forces in the UK, is it not a simple basic fear of getting shot without... I mean, I often wonder about that. Is there that fear?
I guess there is. And I think, you know, you have to go in with your eyes open. And the reality is, you know, people have and do lose their lives in all armed forces and in the Royal Marines. And it happened when I was when I was a Royal Marine, you know, to colleagues. But yeah, I think, you know, I think it's like a lot of things when we look at sort of risk, we anticipate risk and look at risk. I think if I'm honest, you just think it probably won't happen to me and you rationalize it that way, which is probably not the most logical thought process. But I think that is obviously a clear risk, but the risk is the reward is worth that risk. Yeah.
So then when guys get that call or the instruction to say, all right, you're up, you're active duty, here you go, you're off to Afghanistan in 2 weeks or 2 days, I don't know how it works exactly, do you say, yes, this is what I was here for, or do you go, oh, man, I might have done without this and just done the training?
My personal response, my personal experience, sorry, of that would fall across age lines. I was a little bit older when I joined, and when I the build up when I went to Afghanistan was very long. It's almost a year of pre-deployment training that gradually builds up to more and more specific sort of tactics and drills, et cetera, that are relevant and pertinent to the operational environment. We were told we were doing ground holding in Helmand, and that's, to be honest with you, about as fruity as it gets in Afghanistan when we were out there. A lot of people were very happy with that because we get to do the job that we train for. And I'm not saying I wasn't, but I would be lying if I said there wasn't some element of me that had some severe, not reservations, but I was worried and I knew that possibly we wouldn't be coming back on the plane with everybody who left. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, very interesting. So let's get on to some of the specifics about what we want to talk about today. And I think this is where it becomes very interesting because you sent us this amazing document which kind of outlines some of the training and some of the challenges that you faced as part of the Royal Marines and particularly around the training. And the story that Ross related to me is, and you can maybe add some color to this, is that even before the guys get off the train at the training center, some of the guys, literally by looking at the training center, they don't even get off the train because they're intimidated so much. So understanding the why of why you need to be there is important. So just add to that, because I'm fascinated to know, as we've just discovered from you, knowing the why seems quite important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'll try and sort of set the scene, as it were, or as you say, set, put some colour to that. So Lymston Commando is the Commando Training Centre of Royal Marines, and that's down in Devon. And it's serviced effectively by its own railway platform, which until quite recently, I believe, you couldn't alight at unless you had official business at Lymston. So if you're on that small rickety train from Exeter St David's, there'll be 60 young men on there with black bags, looking quite scared, all heading in one direction. And as you roll into the station, the view you're greeted with is the River X to your right and the mud flats. And to your left is the bottom field or assault course, as most people would know that. And it becomes a daunting and harrowing sort of view that sort of greets you every time you arrive back at that destination. Recruit training usually starts with around 60 people. And as Ross portrayed to you, one guy didn't get off the train and went all the way to Exmoor and then got the train back to Exeter and we never saw him again, which I sympathise with, if I'm honest with you. But
I mean, it seems very early on in the process that happens. And you say it's just that person sitting on the train, not 100% knowing his why, and just that was just enough to tip him over the edge of not getting off the train.
Yeah, sorry, Mike. I think you're absolutely right. Knowing the why or making sure that your motivation is true as to why you're going to embark on this, which you, you don't know exactly what's going to happen to you, but you know it's going to, you know, it's going to be a difficult and difficult process, and quite an extended one. Making sure that your motivations are true, I think, is so important, because it just builds a foundation that everything else rests on. And without it, it all just crumbles like a pack of cards, really. Because as soon as pressure gets applied to you, be that, like you mentioned earlier, emotional, physical stress, you then question, and it becomes too easy to put your hand up and say, I don't want to do this. Yeah.
Can I ask you, what commitment has been made by the time you get onto that train? Have you committed to going there with the intention of doing the 32 weeks fully? Have you already been screened? Have you already been approved to actually go on that level of training? In other words, are you going in feet first, eyes closed, jumping off a cliff, or have you sort of edged your way to that point by then?
No, it's definitely a gradual process. There's the initial, obviously you sign up to actually start the process in terms of enrolling, but there's at my time of joining, there were two sort of criteria, physical tests that you had to pass. And you were still a civilian at the time. So there was the pre-joining fitness test, which is a pretty basic treadmill test carried out at sort of a corporate gym. And it takes place around the country. The specs to pass that are not particularly arduous, if I'm honest with you, but it's the first sort of level of filtration, effectively, to check that you kind of are training correctly and have the necessary sort of baseline level of fitness to sort of start training. The second one is more arduous, and when I was sort of going through the process, was known as the pre-Royal Marines Commando course, so PRMC, and that actually takes place in Limpstone, in Devon, at the actual training camp, and it's a 3-day exercise. Or you attend that as a civilian again, so at any point you can leave. There's no sort of, you know, you aren't committed to it, and it involves some criteria tests, so bleep tests, push-ups, sit-ups, pull-ups, you know, where you're actually measured on metrics, and you have to pass a certain and achieve a certain score. And there's also what's known as the determination test, which happens on the bottom field or the assault course, as I mentioned earlier. And that really just consists of being thrashed by a Royal Marines PTI for a couple of hours just to see if you can get anyone to quit and go home.
One of the interesting things about that is that you obviously went into this having some sort of level of confidence in your ability, because I can't imagine that if you were somebody who struggled with cross country at school or anything like that, you would want to get involved in something like that. So maybe give us a background as to where you got that confidence to know that you could achieve the physical goals.
Yeah, so I've been involved in sport all my life since I was very young. I used to race cross country mountain bikes from about the age of 11. So I had like pretty decent like background in just being sporting, I guess. So a decent base level of fitness. Also, you are aware as you embark on the process of like the criteria scores that they're looking for. So how many press ups you have to do in 2 minutes, for instance. And so that's a clearly definable thing that you can measure, and you can do that in your own front room. And if you can only do two, then there's not a lot of point in you going to Limpston to see if you can join the Royal Marines. But it's something you can work at, and it's just obviously a learning curve, or you slowly build yourself up towards those goals. And then once you start getting close to being able to achieve the maximum scores on those tests, it just builds a bit of confidence in yourself that you can go and attend and give a good example of yourself, really. Yeah.
So those early tests that you did, was there a sense that you were easily achieving them, therefore you had the confidence that you knew you could take that into the what was going to be a very difficult training sets?
So for me personally, achieving definitely the upper body test, so the push-ups and the pull-ups, wasn't easy. But once you got there and you could achieve those at home, once then you had the extra sort of motivation and adrenaline of actually carrying out the tests, you know, at CTC Limpston, you were fairly confident you could achieve that. And you knew that if you, you know, just gave 100% on that determination test and just really went for it, that chances are you would then receive a recruit training date to start training after that. Yeah.
So one of the subjects that you mentioned in the document you sent to us is that the difference between, and we thought it was a difference between sport and what the Royal Marines go to and through in terms of their training, is that controlling the controllables is, there are certain controllables you can control, certain ones that you can't, and how you handle those two aspects of it. talk about controlling the controllables, because that's probably the least interesting. The second half is probably the more interesting.
So, yeah. So depending on what you're looking to do, be that run a 5K fun run, be that run a marathon, or it doesn't really matter what the event is. Behind that, and before you arrive at the event, there are numerous things you can do that are within your control. Literally, you know, and that, obviously that sounds quite obvious, but so there's, you know, how am I going to get to the race or the event? The training that you do to arrive, and it leans back to your point, really, Mike, about did I have the confidence to go to recruit training? The controllables I can control in that situation are: I can make sure I can do 60 press-ups in 2 minutes. That's within my gift if I have the time to do it. And so I know when I arrive that I've done everything I can to meet that criteria test, just to sort of define that as an, or give an example of that. So for me, what I learned was that if I can manage to control those bits, the things that are within my sort of gift effectively to control, it manages to reduce the noise and the stress around either events or things you're going to attend, which are always in the background, and just add to that sort of already sort of overall state that you get when you're about to compete in whatever event it is that you've decided is your goal. Yeah. Mm.
And how do they teach you that in the Royal Marine training? Because I think it's fair to say, maybe not, but you'll correct me, I'm sure, that when you are being prepared for the situations that you are, most things are going to be out of your control, and you have to actually learn to let go of those things. So how do you identify them, and then how do you cope with knowing that they're there and you've got no influence over them?
Yeah. So that's a great point, Ross. I think as to put it into a military context, exactly as you say, Ross, the amount of controllables in your gift reduce sometimes only to literally your own personal administration. So the fact that your bag is always packed correctly, you know where the things are in your rucksack, your weapons works, it's well oiled, it's serviceable. Sometimes the controllables sort of begin and end there. There's nothing else you know. But at that point, I think if you know that you're good to go, then that's the first step, and that is a huge help and a massive sort of de-stressor, effectively, in that environment. If you know that you and your section around you, who have already been through the training and also doing the same things as you're doing, so preparing, making sure their kit's in good order, I think that gives you a good sort of foundation to build on. Then you can face the uncontrollables, which are numerous, as you say.
You describe it in your document as the dislocation of expectation. And give us an example of how they train you in that, because that is really the difference between, as you say, racing a cycle race on the weekend where there are lots of controllables. In the army, it's life or death, and anything can happen.
So it's, even before you go there, because, you know, the control of controllables is one principle that applies very easily across Marines versus sport. This is one that you introduced me to, these words, dislocation of expectation, that mm-hmm. really piqued my interest, because my whole PhD was in exactly the opposite thing. So maybe explain what it is and then how it gets taught.
Yeah, so how I would define that really is it's it doesn't really matter what the event is. It could be going to the shops to get a pint of milk. It could be running a marathon. It could be a military operation. What happens is, and what they try to do in training, or what they achieve in training, is you have an idea of the predefined endpoint of that exercise, of that run, of that event, and the training team will change that, basically. And in doing so, it tests people's resolve and also builds people's resolve. So, for an example, we will undertake what we think is it's called a yomp in the Royal Marines, but basically means walking with your rucksack and kit and equipment. It's just a slang word in the Royal Marines. And say you think you're walking from point A to point B, at which point you'll be either picked up by a helicopter, some sort of motorized transport, anything that isn't you walking, basically. At that point, you will arrive and they will break the bad news to you that that transport isn't available anymore, and we're continuing the rest of it on foot. Which doesn't sound that bad on sort of a a Skype call, but when it happens to you when you've been outside in, on Dartmoor for a week, it can be pretty heartbreaking and really break your morale. That would be the dislocation expectation. That's how I would describe it. Yeah, it's just that moving of the goalposts, really, without your knowledge. Yeah.
Give us an example of one particular occasion that happened in.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said about the Dharma one, I think it was on one of our final exercises in training. So for that, we'd been out for probably about a week on Dartmoor, I think. And the weather had been pretty horrendous. It was in the UK winter, and Dartmoor's pretty inhospitable then. It seems to have a permanent rain cloud sort of tethered to it, as a national park. We were then doing what we thought was what's known as an extraction yomp. So you're basically walking out of the operation. So you're walking out to get transport away from where you've been conducting your patrols, your exercise, etc. And we were meant to be being picked up by a Chinook on top of Gutter Tor, which is a small hill, small mountain on Dartmoor. We arrived on time, and we were ready for the transport. We had our sort of infrared glow sticks out for the helicopter to come down. Everyone's like, oh, this is it. You know, everyone's just looking forward to getting on that and probably falling asleep, even though, at which point the training team then informed us, sorry, lads, no helicopters today. They aren't flying. At which point we had to then bivvy up overnight. So sleep overnight in our, and then complete the extraction yomp the following day. Yeah, which was another, I don't know exactly how far it was, but it was a decent.
So just to give that context, so you'd been on Dartmoor for how many days before that extraction?
It was probably a good 7 days, I would have said, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So, and that's without hard cover, generally, we would call it. So no, you haven't got a roof over your head at any point in that time, yeah.
And do you, I mean, when that happens, do you realise that they're trying to train you in a certain method of thought? Or do you genuinely think that the helicopters aren't coming because the weather's bad? And obviously they're doing it deliberately. And maybe the second half to that question is, what do you learn when that happens?
So I think the thought process changes as you go through training. And that's it literally is one of it's one of the definitions or one of the outcomes you want from the training. So at the start of training, the dislocations they give you are quite small. You know, it isn't like that, because most people just be like, no chance, I'm out of here. And just the hand will go up straight on the bus. That's me. You know, that's, you know, you have to apply the load, or both mentally and physically, gradually to recruits. So at the start of training, the dislocations are much smaller. And so you start to learn that really it's a bit of a game, if I'm honest with you. But also you start to develop this just mentality of maybe just accepting that, like you stated, not everything is within your control. And you've already almost pre-thought that when I arrive there, if that helicopter's not there, that's fine, because we've controlled the controllables. So my kit's in my bag, I've got a sleeping bag, everything else that I can do, I've done. And if the helicopter's not there, then we're still in good order. You know, we can do this, basically. Yeah. And as those dislocations become more drastic, as training goes on, that just hardens you to that. And you just, yeah, it really hardens your resolve around that, and you're much more prepared for it when it comes. And yeah.
So by that stage, of course, you're dealing with the elite of the elite, and they've already shown that resilience and that grit, the ability to dislocate. So I would imagine nobody falters at that point. But I mean, my lens is on athletes, and if you entered a marathon with an expectation that was 42.2 km and you got to the anticipated finish line and they said you still got another 3 or 4 blocks to go plus a hill, and we'll see you in like 25 minutes more, most humans would say, screw it, I'm going home and stop.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you'd have probably less people signing up for the race next year.
Right. So, and I realize this is broad, but would you say that that sort of psychological stress and discomfort filters out more people than the physical in the marine context?
I would say so, yes. I think so. I think if you arrive reasonably robust and fit, then I think people can pass that training. The training is progressive physically. People do get injured, and there are things outside of their control that, you know, if you get injured, that's just be unlucky. But I would say, yeah, mentally, that's the thing that people break on generally. Yeah, yeah.
So when you now do a sports event with a known endpoint, do you find yourself consciously ignoring it? Have you become cynical and mistrusting of other?
No. I don't go out on a ride and then think someone's moved the cafe. You know, sort of thing. I don't think that. It's more if something happens in the ride that you weren't planning on. That's probably where it's applicable to maybe to sort of sport where there is a defined start and end point. Even if that's just a solo ride on your own, you know how long it is. But obviously, what happens in that ride isn't always known. You can plan the route, you can know where you're going to stop, etc. But you know, I'll carry the relevant spares, as I'm sure you would, Ross and Mike, when you cycle. And exactly that. That's controlling the controllables. But there may be something happens that is outside of your control. And I guess it's how you face those parts that are probably that you develop. I think to hark back to a podcast, the previous episode of yours, Mike, you interviewed Lachlan Morton. I think he'd just broken his chain on like the Cape Epic or something like that. Or done that long Tour de France ride, like his knee sort of went. That there just gives you, you know, you couldn't probably meet someone who's less sort of, you'd think would be less in the military, but he's obviously got that mindset. Yeah, it's just absolutely crystal clear that he's developed that sort of just attitude where he can just deal with these things, he can roll with them and overcome them. And so it's not just a military, you know, it's not something that you can only learn in the military for sure. It's absolutely not, yeah.
And that's what I was, that's it's really handy you took it in that direction, because I was thinking of this as my next question is, did you encounter personality types that just did this better than others? Because I know athletes who'll be listening to this, and maybe I'm one of them, who really want to understand and know everything that waits for them. They want to try and micromanage and be fully aware of what's around the next corner, the one after that, the one after that. But then you get other people maybe listening to this and going, you know what, that's definitely not me. I don't want to see the route. I don't want to know what's coming. I just want to be in the moment while I'm there and do it that way. And so I wondered whether there were personality types that you met and also which you were. Did you find it easy to learn this skill?
When we all do things, we all have preconceived or we make judgments on people and their personalities and their abilities. And often that happens, like, you know, through all walks of life, and it definitely happens in Roman Reigns training. And you think, oh, this person's really good at map reading. This person's really good at whatever. Sometimes the people who you maybe, for want of a better word, don't, you know, necessarily think is the best soldier. It's right at those darkest moments where everybody's morale is broken that often they come and they're just that diamond that's just formed through that pressure. And they just have like a sense of humor that just is like unbreakable. And that just brings the entire troop up. It's quite strange how everybody plays off each other, and often when everything's going great, everybody can just do their job. But then sometimes when it's really dark and, you know, things are really on, you know, really difficult, it's those people that maybe you hadn't realized their qualities at the time that really shine at that point. And I think that's something that I definitely learned.
So I will say, it's any coaches listening to this, like introducing chaos and disruption and dislocation, the way you talk about it, is actually a really important part. In team sports, you can see obvious reasons is because it's one team against another, and the other team will do things that you couldn't possibly have anticipated, and then you have to fall back on your own controllable and preparation. So I know a lot of coaches will try and shake things up by leaving the team stranded. I know Eddie Jones of England used to sometimes tell the players to be at training and they'd be waiting for a bus that he never booked. And so then they'd have to figure out how to get there themselves. And he was doing it for, I think, similar reasons. But even endurance sports, you know, I hope the lesson coaches take from this is to try and introduce stress that will make the athlete agile in response to, I'm not going to use the word catastrophe because I know it has implications, but chaos and unforeseen things.
Yeah, I think it's quite difficult as a sort of a solo individual or a solo athlete training yourself to do so, because I think the beauty of those bits where the training team move the end, the finish line, are obviously blind, or so as in we aren't party to that information. But obviously as a solo athlete, obviously you know exactly how long your ride's going to be, and as you say, Ross, you like to plan everything, so it's meticulous. So it's quite hard to like organically inject those kind of sort of that jeopardy, for want of a better term, into your sort of events. But what I think probably is quite good in that is maybe thinking about training slightly outside of the box. So instead of just, okay, I want to do a sportive, I want to do a marathon, instead of just running 26 miles, maybe like think about doing sort of trail running. And obviously, we don't want to put, you're not exposing, you know, saying people should risk, put themselves at risk, but, you know, do a bikepacking trip, even though the race you're doing isn't bikepacking, because that just involves, you know, some other elements that aren't in your control. And I think that is really valuable, I think, personally.
I mean, I always think there's some fascinating examples. I mean, I imagine you, if you have a puncture, you're probably the calmest person in the world when you get a puncture. But there are great examples of events like the Barclay Marathons where the chances of finishing are very slim. Therefore, it's just about living in that moment. And there are so many uncontrollables in that environment that you can get through them. And I think about these long-distance cycling events like Transcontinental and Nord Kap and those sort of events where there are lots of things that you're completely out of control of, mostly the weather, that you just have to fight your way through. So I imagine that resilience that you built up would probably be quite attractive to you as a cyclist to be able to take on those type of events, because it does suit that mentality.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two elements to that. One is building up that resilience, and exactly as you say there, but also then there's also, I guess, learning which kit and equipment to take with you as well, which is also slightly more of an individual skill, but just knowing, and that's born through experience, obviously. And again, you don't have to just learn that in the military. Anyone who takes part in an outdoor activity, they probably only have to sort of descend off a mountain once without a rain jacket. Yeah. And they probably wouldn't do it again. It's a pretty quick feedback loop on that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So just moving on, one of the interesting things that you come up in the document is that when it comes to being in the Royal Marines, there's a lot of stuff where you talked about being in a team, and you talked about how the team dynamic often helps you get through the tough challenges. But essentially, the character of the person that's there is a very individual thing, because if you don't have a strong character, you're not going to get through it. You have to be able to take responsibility for your own environment almost all the time, beyond just the team dynamic. I think there's that element, as you said in the document, when character is defined as when you're doing something when no one is watching, which I think is a lovely way of describing it, because it's that self-motivation that seems to be a strong part of that component of that.
Yeah, so the Royal Marines have a very strong ethos of unselfishness. And so it's sort of drilled into you right from the get-go that you are there and you need to be looking after your, what are known as oppos, so just your colleagues effectively. And that is just hammered home from day one right to the end and all the way through your Royal Marine career. And so you really just go out looking, when you go on exercise, operations, whatever it is, you are always looking around and checking everybody else is okay, including yourself. Obviously, you have to look after yourself, but it's such a strong ethos of the Royal Marines that, you know, we don't leave people behind, and you know, you have to be there for your colleagues. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the basic principles of the training and the ethos of what we're talking about here. So when you talk about basic principles, what do you mean basic principles in Royal Marine training?
So do you mean sort of technically, as in just looking after yourself and just being able to be self-sufficient? Is that?
Yeah, and also what do you need to, in other words, the principles of it are that you need to have that mentality where you can, you know, deal with the dislocation of expectation. But are there also principles in terms of your ability to face danger, for instance, because that is a component that maybe you can't necessarily train for? If somebody's shooting at you from the other side of a field, how do you train for something like that, for instance?
And so, and also to add to that, Richie, you're going to get, I think you said earlier, I think you were older when you joined, which is how old?
I was 24. And 24. So that doesn't sound that old, but it's a bit older than most, yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned to me there's some 16-year-olds who might be there. Oh, and you've got people coming from so many different backgrounds, cultures, and so on. It's really interesting always to me how the Royal Marine will take such a disparate group of people and shape them to ultimately come out with a similar skill set, similar mindset, similar, I'm not going to say personality, but similar approach to problem solving and so on. I'm interested in understanding how they actually go about shaping you that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like exactly as you say, Ross, the age ranges are roughly at recruit training between sort of 16 to 30 years old. I mean, and there's less 16-year-olds than 30-year-olds. Most people are probably around 19, I'm guessing. But as you said, they come from all walks of life. And I think what happens is with the training is that it all starts at basically first principles and very, very basic. So once you start recruit training, you go into a thing called foundation where you all live in one big massive dorm or room, and you are taught, I mean, the basics. And I mean the basics. And I think we talked about this, Ross, where you're taught how to shower, which I know people are going to be like, did I just hear that guy right? you're taught how to, you know, iron your kit. And it starts real, real bottom level. So everybody's brought up together in terms of their skill level. And it isn't until, you know, a couple of weeks on that you actually start doing anything that really massively resembles sort of what you would probably generally class as any sort of military training. A lot of it's really just administration. But what it's doing is just instilling in you like those principles of keeping all your kit in good order, keeping yourself in good order, and just setting the foundation, which is exactly the name of the reason it's named that, for them to go on and succeed at sort of the more arduous tasks. And to go to your point, Mike, about sort of, you know, the danger or facing the danger that you do face in operations, I must be honest, it's I'm not entirely sure that we really know exactly how that training makes that happen exactly, because in training you are subjected to sort of, you know, blank fire exercises. So you do face an enemy with weapons who have blank rounds, and it is amazing what that can do in terms of, like, you know, piquing your adrenaline and making it feel like it's real life. But effectively you do still know that you aren't actually going to get shot, but it is amazing when it actually happens for real that the skills and drills and the muscle memory just kicks in.
And have you been shot at?
I have had the pleasure from quite a long way away, but close enough. Yeah,
just describe what that feels like when it first happens to you.
It's a strange thing because I think I don't want to make it sound like out of Afghanistan the entire thing was just, you know, just some crazy sort of war movie. It wasn't. It ebbs and flows between actually quite a lot of doing nothing and boredom to sort of the most hair-raising adrenaline rush that you've ever had in your life. And it's that switch that is probably the most profound. But yeah, when you hear the crack and thump of a small bumblebee coming over your head, it's just you soon switch on. Yeah.
And as you say, what you've said well there is that the training that's been ingrained in you kicks in almost subconsciously, because it's so ingrained that you know what to do in that situation, because anybody else without that training would probably go into a state of panic.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, so it's just, it almost surprises yourself because it feels like a slightly out of body experience. Like you aren't actually doing it. The round comes over your head and straight away you just turn towards it, return fire. Everyone's down on their belt buckle. It's just instant. And it's just, yeah, it's a very strange feeling, because then you come back and you sort of then effectively decompress from that environment and think about it. And it feels like it was happening to somebody else. It's quite a strange sensation, I must be honest.
Sure.
It's probably a state of flow almost, I guess. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah. From the perspective of those who are instructing and training you during what is, I think, a 32-week long course, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I would say their main objective is to establish that when you find yourself in that situation, you're not going to be the one who panics. and you can't physically deal with the stress that's about to be unleashed on you.
That's absolutely right, yeah. I mean, that's definitely got to be one of the main sort of KPIs they're looking for, exactly, yeah.
So they work backwards from basically the most extreme situation you can probably be placed into. I'm curious to know, in that process, you know you're being watched by these guys and they're looking to see and they're testing you and they're saying, you know, we've seen one or two things from Richie that make us wonder. Do they say it like this? They say, let's put Richie in a particularly stressful situation and see how he copes? Or do they always treat you as one part of a whole and leave it up to obvious failures to filter people out?
I think for the most part, most people are treated fairly equally in terms of the stresses and things they're subjected to. But however, you can be sort of promoted to be like a section commander in training, for instance. And I think they often do that to see about your leadership skills. And that's completely, there's two sides to that. One is if they see someone who has potential, they'll put that person and see if they can deal with like the extra stress and responsibility of commanding their peers. But I also think they use it to see if you know, if we just add one more straw to this camel's back, is it going to break, basically? Mm. Yeah. And just,
How flexible or agile is the instruction procedure? Because I think one of the dilemmas for coaches is, especially in team environments, is that some players need a soft touch, some players need a hard bat. some players need encouragement, others might deal with criticism. Do you have that kind of relationship with the instructor where they'll say to you, listen, you're looking good in some respects and so on? In other words, are you coached or are you merely tested, and the constant procedure of testing is what either makes or breaks the Marine?
There's criteria tests that you have to pass, but to say it was just a series of tests would be unfair to the training teams at Limston. No, it's definitely coaching. So, you know, everybody's coming, you know, and just to give it a really real basic example of the UK, it's unlikely anyone in the UK there would have ever held a weapon and then or even fired a gun. So right there, you've got some people will be responders and non-responders, as you would say, Ross, to sort of that coaching. Mm. And some people need more nurturing than others. At that point, the training team, if there's a non-responder, don't just sort of give up the ghost and say, you know, you haven't got what it takes to cut it. You know, those people will usually give them sort of either extra lessons, extra remedial training. There is a limit to that because obviously it is a bit of a big machine in terms of you're quite a small cog in a big machine, and they haven't got unlimited time. And obviously the training moves on through time, but throughout training, the training team are pretty proactive in bringing people on and sort of trying to bring everybody up to a standard, because they're one of their main motivations, and definitely the motivation they sort of say to us is they don't want to pass out people, because the Royal Marines is a pretty small community and they don't want to give people a green beret who then may meet friends they know and then they'd be disappointed in the people that they've passed out. So, you know, just say for instance yourself, Ross, was one of the PTIs there. You would have professional, you know, professional sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Responsibility, really, that the people you were passing out could do the job.
Because it's always interested me, like, you've got what is in effect a mass approach to training people, mm-hmm. but they're individuals, and I think, for instance, of injuries that would happen, because if anyone ever said to me, how much should I train for my first marathon to not get injured? My answer always would be, well, that depends on the person, and we don't apply one rule to a big group of 60 people. But in the Marine context, they are doing that, and I've always wondered how they adjust on the fly when a person does have a stress fracture or a muscle strain or a ligament issue. Do they help that person through, or do they just say, come back next year and try again?
So probably the answer to that is probably to explain how the training works in terms of the different troops. So like I said, I arrived on the platform with 60 other guys, and let's just say that was numbered troop 100. 2 weeks later, there'll be another 60 guys on that platform, and that's troop 101. Mm. And the following 2 weeks later, there'll be a troop 102. If someone gets injured in troop 100 and say it's just a muscle tear, but it means they can't continue with the training in that troop, they then go to a holding company called Hunter, which is like a remedial sort of company where you tread water in terms of recuperation. And then once you're ready to rejoin training, you can then step back into a troop that was behind your original troop and then pick up where you left off effectively. So you can pass those tests. Yeah. That's how that's managed. That covers both remedial training in terms of someone who isn't up to scratch to pass that test at that time. But it also covers injuries as well. Yeah. Yeah.
You touched very briefly at the start, maybe we'd get a bit more detail when you talk about progressive training. And there's two parts of this that I'd like to ask you about. The perception of a Marine is always what we see in the movies, the Rock, you know, Dwayne Johnson, the big, bulky, muscular guy. But from what I've read, the reality is that, you know, most of these guys are wiry, you know, wiry athletic individuals. But first of all, talk us through the progressive training aspect. You said at the start it's very progressive. The idea is to get people fitter. It's not a sudden shock thing. Just give us some more detail about how that works. Is it fitness versus strength? What component is strength? What component is fitness?
Yeah, sure. So the first 9 weeks, in terms of your fitness training, generally take part in a gym. And when I say gym, I mean like an old school gym with rope climbs, pull-ups, press-ups, and shuttle sprints, that type of thing, not like a weights room or a with machines. Mm-hmm. And it's all body weight in trainers, shorts and t-shirt generally. So it's all body weight, and there's obviously some running there as well. But again, it's unweighted, so you're not carrying any kit and equipment, and it's all done in trainers. And the idea of that is obviously then to bring everybody up in terms of fitness so that they can start adding load. And I mean that both in terms of weight and also training stress. From that 9 weeks, you then move on to the bottom field, which is the assault course. And then you start doing more runs in boots. And then you start adding, they then start adding some more kit to you. So you have your what's called webbing, which is kind of, if you've seen in kind of like most movies, it's kind of like sort of, you have the pouches on your hips, which carry your ammunition and food and water, etc. And that weight that gets added to that webbing just gradually increases. So again, there's rope climbs, there's the assault course, there's running, there's fireman's carries. So you're carrying other individuals carrying that kit. So slowly the weight increases and the stress increases, and also the duration of those events. I think what the difficulty is in terms of the military training is that's different than sport really is. You're trying to get people fit. But also, like we said earlier, introduce grit or develop grit in those people. And therefore, sometimes you have to do training when you're not in your best sort of most rested state, for instance. Not every time you arrive at the assault course, are you well rested, you know, well fed, etc. So, you know, I'll be honest with you, Raw Marines training is basically chronic overload. I mean, it's overtraining and definitely a lack of sleep as well throughout, really. The difference, obviously, with sport is you would choose to do your training. Hopefully, you would be well rested and all that sort of good stuff, really. Then what happens, really, the exercises you go on. So when I say exercises, I mean field exercises. So you're out, like I said, on Dartmoor in Wales or whatever it is. The rucksack, or as it's known, Bergen, that you'll carry, will gradually increase in weight just naturally because of the kit and equipment you're carrying. So slowly you'll start using radios. You'll start taking actual ammunition with you. More food, because your exercises become increasingly long. So before it was a 2-day exercise and you needed 2 days of food, and now you need a week's worth of food. And so slowly throughout the exercises, they increase in length and they're more arduous, but also the weight increases as well.
And what does a typical Marine look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, probably like me, but younger. I think you're right. Like a lot of guys, once they finish training, they are not muscle bound, sort of like Dwayne Johnson looking. That is not what the training develops, really. It's long endurance events, and there is strength that's done at the start and during the assault course phases, but effectively you're trying to get people who are good at carrying quite a lot of weight over a lot of distance, and that's reasonably low intensity really in some ways, but it's just very, very long durations. And obviously that doesn't develop sort of, you know, defined musculature necessarily. It just makes you really good at carrying really heavy stuff.
In fact, I'd say, though, wouldn't it be accurate that it's not even a case that the training doesn't develop the Dwayne Johnson physique? It actually selects against it.
And it's just for interference with that, I would have said, yeah.
So when you're in Troop 100 and it's now 6 weeks in and Troop 103 is arriving, do you look at the incoming recruits and say, nah, not going to make it, he looks okay, he's not going to make it? Do you have bets going like that?
That's a good question, actually, Ross. That's a good question. I'm trying to think back now to, like, because when I arrived, everybody's hanging out at the accommodation window shouting, don't do it, like trying to get everyone to get back on the train, which is always great. But I think sometimes you see people and, sounds pretty bad, but yeah, you are probably like, okay, that guy is probably about 65 kilos and he's about to carry a rucksack that's 55. That's going to be difficult. But but apart from that, it's surprising. Like we alluded to, there is a physical side to it, no doubt, but the mental resilience side of it is so important that it probably, whilst it doesn't override the physical side, you know, you need that. And obviously if you get injured or can't do the test, then you can't become a Royal Marine. But it's amazing what the mental side can actually get you through.
Because power to weight ratio, I imagine, it seems like it's a game of power to weight ratio, because as you say, the 65 kilogram guy might be absolutely brilliant at the endurance events without any packs on, but as he starts adding weight, the bigger the individual, the stronger they'll be, therefore they'll be able to carry it. So I imagine as the weight gets added, that the smaller individuals maybe not smaller, maybe less strong individuals get weeded out, and the stronger guys get weeded in. I don't know. Is it a typical guy like 80 kilos and, you know, 5'9"? I mean, would that be a sort of essential point for a Marine to look like?
Yeah, it probably is. That's probably exactly what I was. I was probably 5'10", but yeah, 80 kilos sounds about right. Yeah, pretty. I think you're actually right there, Mike, in terms of, like, you know, muscle mass, etc. Just to sort of take on that load, you need that. And whilst I don't know if this is the direction you want to go in, but from 2017, women could be allowed into the Royal Marines or allowed to join recruit training in the Royal Marines. And for the record, I think that's a good thing. But I think, as we all be aware, obviously, as a group, they're generally lighter than men.
Mm.
And therefore, the percentage of weight they're carrying to their body weight makes some of the exercises very difficult. Yeah. Yeah.
When they were allowed to join, did the Marines accommodate those physical differences by, for instance, setting different targets and different tasks? So in other words, the standard is the standard. Here's the bar, and you clear it, and it doesn't matter who or what. This is where you go.
That's it, yeah.
That's fair. I mean, it has to be like that because battle's not going to make those accommodations, right?
Yeah,
exactly. And I think it also comes down to sort of unit pride, for want of a better word. The ethos behind it, you know, you need to know that the person standing to your left and right has passed the same bar as you. Mm. Doesn't really matter whether they're male or female, in my opinion, but I think the tests are there for a reason.
And we've spoken about the physical, the physiological, the mental as well. What about and I don't know what the right word is for this, but almost like the academic or the intelligence side of it. Do they teach you thinking?
Yeah. So, I think if you watch sort of generally their American films, but it seems like it's just like a bit of a brainless exercise where you just get put for a sausage factory and shouted at a lot. That isn't really the case. And there's definitely, there's much more sort of individual skills. So, and sort of finer skills. So for instance, navigation, using and setting up radios, you know, which sounds really basic, but, you know, communicating on a radio correctly is really important. Medical skills, I think I said that already. So weapon skills, be that, you know, stripping, clearing your weapon, shooting, all those sort of things are, you know, much more intelligence based. And some people, like you said, are responders and non-responders to it. And so individual thinking, like I think that's one of the reasons I sort of joined the Royal Marines, really. It felt like you were given more autonomy than possibly in other forces. Again, I haven't been in those forces, so I couldn't say if that's totally true, but that definitely felt like, you know, often you were operating in as much smaller groups as opposed to a large section.
Just a couple of final questions from me. I'm interested to know, do you know what sort of, when you do those 7-day treks and through the Dartmoor, do you know what your calories that you're consuming? I mean, you talked about carrying that stuff with you. How do you eat, and what's your intake in those situations?
Yeah, so if you're on exercise or on any operation that's away from a main patrol base, you'll be on a ration pack effectively. So it comes in a box, it's numbered, and it will have a menu. and it'll have a breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and some sort of like energy powders and stuff like that type of thing, and tea and coffee making sort of sachets. I think generally they have about 4,000 calories in those in each box, but I'm pretty sure on arduous exercises you're burning way above that. Bear in mind you're outside in the winter, so just that alone you must consume or burn a lot of calories just to stay warm, plus carrying your kit. And I think by the end of the exercise, I mean, those ration packs are often, for short exercises, I would save like the rice packs and then bring them on the harder exercises, so you can like bulk up your meals with rice, even though, you know, sausage, egg, and rice doesn't sound that appealing, but it's just about getting calories on board, really. Yeah.
How does that compare to a Tour de France rider's intake, Russ?
Yeah, I'd say average in the Tour is between 4 and 5.
Yeah.
Super tough 6-hour mountain day, 6 to 7. I think the record is about 11,000, a Polar Explorer, and that's, as Richie says, because in part the cold. And in part, the fact that you're active for not 5 or 6 hours, but maybe 21 hours in that day. And even if it's low intensity, the cold is in itself energy demanding. But then you're trekking a sled up a slope So that was the record that I've seen. It was published by...
Yeah, I mean,
Mike Stroud was the Polar Explorer, and they documented that.
And what sort of stuff is in that pack? I mean, you talked about there being energy powders, but what? And you talked about rice and coffee. And what other stuff is in that pack?
So they all come in sort of boiling a bag packets, and to be heated in your jet boil that you've got. So just a small camping stove type thing. Mm. And generally, you know, it can be anything from like sausage and beans as a breakfast, mushroom stroganoff. It all sounds great, but it's not brilliant, if I'm honest with you. There's quite a lot of pasta dishes and stuff, but there's a reasonably like diverse menu, and some of the bits you want to avoid. Actually, I said mushroom stroganoff, and that's a no-go. Just if anyone's listening, think about joining the Royal Marines. Just avoid that menu like the plague. But yeah, and mushroom pate and stuff, but they're all really calorie dense sort of meals. Not all of them are terrible in truth, but I mean, you wouldn't choose to eat it.
The interesting thing is that we talk about multi-day events in sport, and even people that do long sport events where they get sick and tired of eating the sweet stuff. But the reason why I asked that question is that you're eating whole foods over those 7 days. So it's not energy drinks and that sort of thing. It's whole foods.
Yeah, it's whole food. Yeah, so that's a good point, Mike. Yeah, it isn't just, you're not just doing sort of Cliff bars and energy powders. Yeah, there's whole foods in there. Mm. And I think after a certain duration, that would just become untenable in terms of just eating energy foods. You just, really, really, really struggle to keep going on that. I think motivation as well to actually eat it would just completely wane. Mm. Yeah.
When you finish an exercise like that, you've spoken a couple of times about that 7 day Dartmoor thing. Do they have a medical assessment of all the trainees at that point? And is there other medical support provided on the way?
So generally on exercise, you will have a medic as part of the training, or one of the training team, or most of the training team have got some sort of medical sort of training. And Dartmoor as an area is sort of is quite well used by the UK military, so it's you know the medical team are quite well aware of it. In terms of when you return from exercise, I think you're asked if you have any problems or issues, but I think you're really promoted to self declare those, which probably isn't a great system, because I think people often probably hide niggles and injuries longer than they probably would in civilian life, because you really don't want to get, like I said, back trooped into one of those troops or go into hunter company to sort of not continue training. And at Lipson, there's a medical unit or bay that's pretty well serviced and quite well attended usually throughout training by people. I mean, injuries are fairly regular, I think, in training. Stress fractures, as you mentioned earlier, are probably one of the main serious injuries that occur.
Then sort of semi-related, do they teach you psychology in the training process, or do they take the approach that actually the training is the psychology and it's taught almost in a functional way, or do they actually put you in front of someone who teaches you about resilience and grit and motivation?
I feel like it's part of the training more than it's taught separately or explicitly. I think it's just a byproduct of the training, if I'm honest with you. Yeah, that feels like it chimes with my experience of going through training. No doubt there's sort of, you know, tips and tricks to motivate you, you know, and it doesn't really matter what those are. Some of them are just motivational quotes, you know, in your bed space where you sleep at night type thing, you know, or pictures, or you know, that type of thing. But yeah, for me, really, from the best of my memory, it was more just it was a byproduct of the training.
And then just and as Mike said, we'll wrap up soon. I've got a few questions, actually, I hope engaging ones. The one thing I would like for you to explain is, how do you then, at the end of all of this, 32 weeks in, how do you then go about earning that Green Beret?
Yeah, so throughout those criteria tests you have to pass, as I said, but really the whole training period of the 9 months, 32 weeks, culminates in what are known as the commando tests. And there's four of those, and they take place over 5 days. So there's one rest day effectively in there. And the purpose of those is really just the last challenge, really, just to prove you've got the physical and mental capability to earn that Green Beret. Did you want me to go through what they are?
Explain maybe briefly what the tests are. Because there'll be people listening to this who think, I could do that, maybe.
Yeah, so I think before I explain the tests, is important to say is that probably individually the tests are actually quite passable by someone who's pretty fit.
Yeah,
they aren't impossible by any means. I think what makes them very, very difficult is the fact that you arrive having done 8 and a half months of pretty arduous training, and you are definitely not, you know, well rested, you know, and in the best, you're in good shape, but physically you are very fatigued. You've got a high level of fatigue. So the tests are what is known as the endurance course, and that consists of there's basically a 2 mile series of tunnels on Woodbury Common, which go through water dips, that type of thing. You run that in with your weighted webbing and rifle, and then there's a 4 mile run back to camp, which then culminates in a 10 round sort of target shoot. The reason for the target shoot, which is not particularly difficult to pass, but is to ensure that when you're doing that test and going through these water tunnels and through all the mud, that you're looking after your weapon and rifle. Because in fact, it's to replicate sort of getting to battle and keeping your kit and equipment in good working order, because there's no point arriving if your rifle malfunctions when you get there. Mm. So it's just, that's usually around, I think the pass time is 72 minutes on that, but most people do it with just over an hour. But it's a pretty, pretty good workout, that one. The easiest one would be probably the 9 mile speed march. A speed march is how the Royal Marines get a body of men or women from point A to point B as a unit. So we all run together. We usually run the flats and downhills, and you walk the uphills, and you all walk in step as a sort of three abreast. And that's run up, has to be completed in 90 minutes. So it's 10 minute miles, which, bad maths, but it's probably, what's that, 6 minute, 10 kilometers?
Yeah, just something outside like that. 6 minutes a K, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, which is not particularly arduous in terms of pace, but again, you're carrying your kit and equipment. Mm. And it's run as a positive split, sorry. So the first couple of miles are absolutely flat out, at which point you think, I'm never going to be able to finish this, but they're trying to get time in the bank for the latter part of the course. The third test is the Tarzan Assault course, which is a high wires course, which starts with what's known as the death slide, where you chuck yourself out of a 40-foot tower down a zip line with no harness, just a rope strop around your arms. And then you go around a series of sort of high wire obstacles, a bit like you would see at sort of like a thing like Go Ape or something like that. I don't know if you guys have that sort of thing, but it's like that, but without a harness again. And then it finishes with an assault course, and then you have to climb a 30-foot wall at the end. I think the time limit for that is 13 minutes, and it's pretty short, but it's just eyes bleeding from the minute your feet touch the ground already for 12, 13 minutes. And then for me and most people, the hardest test to pass or the most arduous is what's known as the 30 miler. And that is, as you would expect, a 30 mile run across Dartmoor carrying your kit and equipment, at which point at the end of that, if you pass, you're awarded your Green Beret. But that is a pretty arduous event. I found that incredibly difficult and was in a world of pain by the end of that, I can tell you. I don't know if it's known as cardiac drift, Ross, but whatever it is, where you're going the same speed, but the level of effort you're putting out is just so much higher than at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's almost unbelievable. Yeah, I was basically felt like I was fully sprinting just to keep basically walking.
And that's, you've got 8 hours, right, to do 30 miles.
Yeah, 8 hours. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Which again, you know, it's a bit longer than a marathon, so it doesn't sound that difficult, but the terrain is unforgiving at best. Yeah. Mm.
And then, okay, last three questions. I'll try and be quick. You mentioned earlier that you'd done some training with the US. What's the main difference between how they train in the US and what you did, if any?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of difference between the US Marines and the Royal Marines. I think that's a question a lot of people ask. I haven't been for US Marine training, and I don't wish to sort of say anything bad about them. I would say the Royal Marines are not really comparable to the US Marines, apart from in name. They are their own sort of fighting unit, and they're a massive, you know, the US has also got a huge army, and the Marines is one part of that. I think having fought with them, they're just really good men, but I think we would be more comparable to sort of a slightly more elite unit that the US has. So something like Delta or the Stills, probably, I would say.
Yeah, the Rangers or something. Is that the Delta?
Yeah, possibly something like that. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure of their, like, the training protocol they go through. From what I do know a little bit about it, I think it's a lot more, you get a lot less autonomy or a lot less freedom to sort of make your own decisions. That would be how I would sort of probably, but I'm probably speaking about something I don't have a in-depth knowledge of, if I'm honest with you.
Okay, question two. You've obviously had the benefit of almost a decade out, plus wisdom and maturity and so on. But thinking back now, What's the most surprising thing that you'd learned from it, where you took expectation in when you stepped off that train, and the one thing that really shook you and said, wow, that I didn't expect?
I think it's a slightly soft skill, if I'm honest with you, to probably describe that. It's not physical. And it actually happened more when I passed training. So once I passed training, I went on a 3-month deployment around the Middle East, the Mediterranean, on ship. And we dealt at various places and trained indigenous and local forces. But during that, you spend sort of 2 weeks or more at sea sailing between the different places. You're all in a very small sort of mess deck with 3-tier bunks. And I just remember being in a room with probably like 20 other lads. You know, there's no room. Everyone's on top of each other. And I don't remember there being one cross word between anybody. And everyone was just knew that everybody was doing their best, doing their job. You know, and I just compare that to maybe how that would happen in civilian life. And I think everyone would be at each other's throats in about 20 minutes. I think that was the sort of, I don't know, just a thing I look back on and always surprised, which is, maybe not what you're after, Ross, but that's the kind of thing that I take away from it, yeah.
No, that's great. That's exactly what I was after. And then last one, what's the one thing when you watch any Hollywood movie about the military that pisses you off the most as inaccurately portraying what you know to be true?
Let's just go for, there's probably a bit of a list of that. So
all the weapons,
all the weapons they have seem to have unlimited ammunition. I think there's only about 3 films we've ever seen anyone actually reload a weapon. What's quite funny as well is when you're actually carrying the amount of kit you are, you feel like it's a bit like when you watch GoPro footage of when you're mountain biking. It's always unimpressive. And it's the same when you're running with kit. You think you're moving at like light speed, and you watch, if you ever see it back, I mean, honestly, it's just, it looks horrendous because you're just going so slow. But obviously in movies, everyone's doing, 100 meter sprints in like 10 seconds, carrying all their ammunition and stuff. And it's just so unrealistic because it is wearing body armor, carrying all your ammunition, medical pack, food, rifle. I mean, that slows you down some. Yeah. It's just...
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks.
Richard, thanks very much for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating. And I think you create an amazing link between your experience of the military and your experience as a cyclist. And it's lovely to hear those comparisons. I don't think I would ever want to join the army. I certainly don't have the grit that you talk about in that. I don't think I ever will have that sort of grit. But there are certain lessons that we can take from this that I think are very valuable. So thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. There's just one thing, sorry, I should probably correct, just because I know there'll be, if there's anyone else who's a Royal Marine listening to it, that the Royal Marine are part of the Royal Navy and not the Army. But that's the only thing I should probably,
That's
sorry,
good
I just know that if I didn't say that, someone would be on Twitter probably all over it.
Absolutely,
so I'll just
correct.
Nip that one in the bud. But thanks, guys. It was a pleasure.
Great.
Absolute
thanks
pleasure.
Very much.
Thanks,
mate.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.